From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Welcome, Anita and Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
Well, here are the issues. President Biden signed into law a sweeping bill to lower health care costs and address climate change, sealing a legislative victory more than a year in the making. The new law, the Inflation Reduction Act, includes a $369 billion investment in climate and energy policies, $64 billion to extend a policy under the Affordable Care Act, and a 15% corporate minimum tax aimed at companies that earn more than $1 billion a year. Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney, Donald Trump's fiercest Republican adversary in Congress, was defeated in a GOP primary Tuesday night, falling to Harriet Hegelman, a rival backed by the former president. The FBI continues to sort through the troves of documents collected from Trump's Florida Mar-a-Lago estate last week. Some of the documents are labeled top secret and highly classified. The Taliban marked a year since they seized the Afghan capital, Kabul, a rapid takeover that triggered a hasty escape of the nation's Western-backed leaders and fundamentally transformed the country. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Catherine, I'm sure there were celebrations on Capitol Hill over the historic Inflation Reduction Act. So how important was it that Congress was able to get it to the president to sign into law?
Well, there certainly were celebrations. You're very right about that, Kim. And it was important because they, of course, were leaving on that 6-week summer recess. Everything in Capitol Hill runs on deadlines, on timelines, and when they're in session and when they're out of session. So it was really important for them to get this done before they left for the summer recess. We know, of course, that this is a midterm election year. So now all of the representatives, senators can turn their attention to campaigning, to holding onto their seats, to talking to voters. And really, that's what they wanted to be doing anyway. So getting this done clears this off their plate and allows them to focus on the midterm elections ahead. And of course, for Democrats, allows them to make the case that Democrats have delivered for the American people, that the Biden administration, even though Biden is running not so great in the opinion polls, they are making the argument that Democrats should remain in office.
And I was there for the actual signing of the bill on Tuesday, and I just want to highlight some of the things that the White House has been telling us that this bill is going to do in their publicity blitz. They say that it A, helps Black communities, B, builds a better future for young Americans, C, lowers energy costs, creates jobs, tackles climate change, D, helps rural communities, and E, advances environmental justice. But I want to note that that's a bit at odds with the name of this thing. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act. The one thing that the White House is not touting, and none of its champions seem to be openly touting, is whether or not it's going to reduce inflation. And that's kind of a big issue. And I think that could possibly raise issues of trust with the American people.
And what will it mean for Democrats with midterm elections coming up?
Well, and that's another important part of when this bill was passed and signed. As I mentioned, they'll be going back to their districts and they can tout that as an achievement that they passed this bill over the summer. They can be talking to their voters directly and saying, look, we just passed this massive legislation, the biggest climate change legislation ever passed in the U.S. They've extended Obamacare subsidies, so people who are concerned about paying for their health insurance on that open marketplace, most people now do not have to be worried about that. There's some very real, tangible results that senators and representatives can talk about with their voters and say, look, we did get these things done, and they'll be pairing it with the Infrastructure Act that was passed earlier, saying, look, President Biden actually passed a fair amount of the agenda that he set out to pass when he became president. And that's something of an achievement for a U.S. president. So that is absolutely something over on Anita's end that will be seen from President Biden in the next few weeks as he makes that tour, telling the American people exactly what this legislation will be doing.
Right. And Biden's going to be going to key states. I think his first stop is going to be in Pennsylvania, which is an important state in this midterm election. And he's going to be promoting this bill. And as Catherine said, she's right, of course, as Catherine always is, just about how this is a feather in the cap of Democrats. But it's also worth noting that when public opinion polls are done on the value of entitlements and services like healthcare, most Americans actually do support those things, no matter how they lean politically. If you ask them, do you want cheaper health care? Most Americans are going to say, yes. Do you want a little bit of help from the government to like make ends meet? The answer is yes. So this is something that might be politically uncomfortable, but is actually quite popular among Americans.
Right. And one of the interesting things about this legislation is that they're not paying for all of it by raising taxes, because, of course, that would be a very bad look, a very hard sell. So instead, what's going to be happening is that there's more funding to hire more IRS agents to go after some of the higher income earners who studies show are not paying their fair share of taxes. So that kind of prevents this argument that, look, you can't pay for these entitlements by raising taxes. They're actually finding the money in new ways. That should hopefully, for Democrats, make that an easier sell when they go out to their voters and say, hey, this is how we're paying for this.
Right. And the key number that Biden keeps stressing is $400,000. That's the cutoff. He insists that no household making less than $400,000 a year is going to see an increase in the taxes they owe. The critical word, though, there is that they owe. I think one issue is that tax policy and tax enforcement are not always on the same page. It is very possible that some of those families who are bringing in less than $400,000 are also taking advantage of tax loopholes, or perhaps taking advantage of not very much monitoring from the IRS to pay less than perhaps the government believes that they should owe. So we might actually see tax bills for some families who have not been, as Biden says, paying their fair share. They may actually find themselves owing more, which is going to hurt. But that's the message, that everybody should pay their fair share into this system. And that's what Biden is promoting.
Good points that you raise with this new act that has been signed into law by the president. Well, Tuesday night was another primary night for elections in some U.S. states. In Wyoming, Republican Representative Liz Cheney was defeated in a landslide victory for Trump-endorsed candidate Harriet Hageman. Now, Catherine, I know you were there in Wyoming, so it doesn't sound like Cheney will be stepping away from the spotlight despite her defeat.
No, she certainly won't, but she, I would say, having spoken to Wyoming voters in the week leading up to the primary, has no political future in that state. We have to remember, Donald Trump won Wyoming in 2020 by 70%. That is the biggest margin of any state he won in the 2020 election. This is a solidly Trump state, and it was a bold move for Cheney to stake out this position criticizing him. She knows that state well enough that she knows that that probably ended her political future there. Talking to voters, it was striking to hear how much they disliked her tone when it came to Donald Trump. A lot of voters told me that she was mean, that she was nasty, that she was unfairly targeting the former president, which is really striking when you think about some of the speeches that we heard from Donald Trump in the past. They also said that they really disliked her father, former Republican Vice President Dick Cheney, and felt that none of the Cheney family really belonged in Wyoming, that they were, you know, something of tacking on to the state's Western independent heritage and not really from the state. And that rings really wrong for people there. They felt like they were almost being used by the Cheney family. So they are all in for Trump. They were telling me that they're very worried about Biden and the economy. That's another concern that voters took to the polls when they were deciding between Hageman and Cheney. They felt that Cheney was a Washington insider who was far too focused on the January 6th committee when they're dealing with more everyday issues like deciding how to pay the bills, the rising cost of food and gas. That really killed Cheney in that primary. So the landslide election results were not really a surprise on Tuesday when I heard them.
Liz Cheney, if she does launch a 2024 presidential campaign, she says it will be to keep Trump out of the White House. If this is really how she feels, how does the Republican Party see her?
Well, she's been expelled from the Wyoming State Republican Party. They do not consider her Republican anymore, which is extraordinary when you remember that she is the daughter of a former Republican vice president. So she will certainly not be getting any help from the Republican apparatus in the state or nationally, really. We're seeing like this separate wing of the Republican Party, but to call it a wing isn't quite correct because that overstates the size of it. We're really talking about a handful of House Republicans, 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump last year for his role in the riot at the U.S. Capitol. Out of those 10 Republicans who voted to impeach him, 8, including Cheney, have lost their primaries and are not going to be reelected or have chosen to retire. So you're not talking about a huge part of the Republican Party that feels this way about Donald Trump. They've basically been marginalized and don't have anywhere to go, don't have any support if they want to challenge Donald Trump in this way.
Right. And I think what this solidifies is something that the president has been saying for several months now. The real opposition to the current leadership is not the traditional Republican Party, but what President Biden terms the ultra MAGA, which is, as Catherine said, what we've just seen. We've seen the old Republican establishment of the Cheneys and the Bushes is making way for the new Republican establishment that is still very much, even 2 years after his departure from office, very much controlled by Donald Trump. So this is going to be a tell of what we're going to be seeing in 2024 at the presidential polls. We're going to probably see this Biden establishment versus whoever it is at the head of the ultra MAGA party.
And I think it's important to say that really for the ultra MAGA party, any revelations that are coming out in the course of the January 6th committee hearings, co-chaired by Liz Cheney herself, are not resonating. I had multiple voters tell me that they don't understand, quote, the January 6th nonsense. They don't understand why this is a focus. They don't think that it's worth that amount of time and effort. And they think that it's a smear campaign against the former president. So anybody who thinks that the January 6th committee is going to be changing hearts and minds out in the country probably has a tough road to go. Liz Cheney is getting all of this documented, but it's unlikely that she's changing the minds of any hardcore Trump voters with any of this investigation.
And it'll be interesting to see in which direction her political career will be heading in the months ahead. And it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, the FBI prepares next steps in their investigation of former President Donald Trump. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voaafrica.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. While the FBI has been sorting through documents, including some labeled top secret and highly classified, that they collected from Trump's Florida resort last week, what is your take overall on the search of Trump's estate?
Let me just say what the White House would say if asked that question, which is they don't want to touch that question with a 10-foot pole because this is so politically sensitive. And so the White House's response anytime they're asked basically any question about this investigation is you need to direct that question to the Justice Department. They are an independent body. So I just want to underscore how politically, I guess the word is really toxic, this is for the current White House because this is something that they don't want to talk about. They may have feelings about it behind the scenes, but they are definitely not talking about it and keeping as quiet as they can.
And that goes for Democrats, too, who are obviously back in their districts, really starting those midterm campaigns in earnest. Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, they've all been asked about this and said, look, we need to let this investigation play out. We are not directly involved in it. This is something that needs to be run by the Department of Justice. And it doesn't really help them out in terms of campaigning to point fingers at the other side when they really want to be going out there and making the case that they've done important work for the American people. I cannot underscore this enough. Like when you go out and talk to voters out in the rest of the country, they are not as dialed into all of these different machinations, investigations, whatever you want to call it, they're more concerned about their daily life. And Democrats know that in order to hold on to their slim majorities in the House and Senate, they need to be making the case that they're going to be getting work done for the American people. Now, over on the other side, on the Republican side, this is certainly something that Republicans are wanting to talk about. And by and large, they are saying that this is a false investigation, that this has been done under political pretenses, that once again, the former president is being politically targeted. And they have been calling for investigations and saying that if Republicans take the House, that the Department of Justice can expect to be called in for an investigation and to be called to account for all of this. So they are biding their time and waiting to see if they do indeed win control of the House. Believe me, this will be discussed next year.
And as you mentioned, there are other ongoing criminal investigations against Donald Trump, who may be seeking a 2024 presidential bid. How will these investigations affect his political career?
I think that's why he garnered the nickname Teflon Don. Nothing seems to stick. I mean, the weight of the criminal investigations against this individual are staggering, but that seems to not affect his support or his voters. He is currently accused credibly of a litany of indiscretions, both civil and criminal, but that doesn't seem to at all be seen by his base as some sort of downside. So I'm not sure how it's going to affect him. One thing that is going to be kind of interesting is if he is actually prosecuted on this latest case, the FBI search of his home, one of the consequences if he is found guilty of these things is that he might be barred from running from office, but that could come a ways down the road. So he could ostensibly declare that he's a candidate. The problem with that is the minute he does that, then campaign finance rules kick in. Since he left office, he's been bringing in $200,000 to $300,000 a day through this super PAC with no requirement to comport with federal campaign fundraising laws. So this is very interesting because that's probably going to unearth some other issues.
Would it be better to never declare his candidacy, throw his support behind somebody like Ron DeSantis, and harness the power of his supporters and his agenda, his beliefs, and throw it behind someone else who doesn't have these issues? Trump can continue fundraising. Everybody in that scenario wins to a certain extent. I wonder if that's how it's going to end up playing out.
If you listen to right-wing media right now, there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, Trump, maybe it's time for him to step aside. And the main candidate that keeps getting mentioned is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. So that is a real possibility. And there's definitely pressure on that side, very gentle pressure, I would say, in public on Donald Trump to do that.
In our last topic, we look at Afghanistan and how the country has changed over the last year, the Taliban struggles to remain internationally isolated, and the economic downturn in the country has driven millions more Afghans into poverty and even hunger. So what is the U.S. response to this decline of Afghanistan?
The U.S. is somewhat hamstrung. We have a leadership in Afghanistan that is not formally recognized by the U.S. This is the Taliban government, the so-called government of Afghanistan. So the U.S. doesn't have a lot of ability to help that country in terms of humanitarian aid. And as we all know, the Biden administration recently made the decision not to release $7 billion in funds held by the Afghanistan Central Bank in U.S. assets, which is money that the Taliban argues that it badly needs to overcome what is a just catastrophic humanitarian crisis, where, as UNICEF says, 95% of Afghans are not getting enough to eat. And we've seen them be beset by natural disasters, instability, violence just in the last year. So this is a real quandary for the Biden administration, because there is, you know, an urge, of course, to help the people of this country, but there aren't many mechanisms for them to do so because there's no diplomatic recognition of this government.
Yeah, and I think that Anita gave a very comprehensive analysis looking forward, but on Capitol Hill, we're still looking backwards at exactly how the withdrawal was mismanaged, or from the perspective of Democrats, could have done better. House Foreign Affairs Republicans released a pretty comprehensive report earlier this week looking back at some of the things that could have done better. And it is striking to see how ill-prepared the U.S. was, particularly the U.S. State Department, the NSC. There was no advanced planning in terms of what could be done to get vulnerable Afghans out, to get Americans out. The U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan was on vacation the last 2 weeks of June and the first week of July in the weeks leading up to the U.S. withdrawal. There were many, many things that could have been done better. The argument, of course, from Republicans is that Biden could have changed how that withdrawal was sequenced. The Biden administration has said that former President Trump committed them to a bad deal in Doha, that committed them to a withdrawal. Foreign Affairs Republicans pushed back on that and said, of course, that Biden could have always changed the terms of the deal, could have left 2,500 troops in Afghanistan to try and minimize some of the damage of that. There is certainly a lot of finger pointing, lessons learned on Capitol Hill still looking back a year later that will definitely be taken into whenever the U.S. goes into another country in the future. I think the memory of that Afghanistan withdrawal will linger for a very, very long time.
Yes, absolutely. And it's time now to find out what's been weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Anita, I will start with you.
Sure. I'm going to take us back to Afghanistan. I'm going to take us back 16 years ago to a graduation I attended in Khost Province, which was Afghanistan's first graduating class of midwives. And I bring this up because what's weighing on my mind right now is the plight of girls and women in Afghanistan and how just in fundamental, elemental ways, life has gotten disastrously worse for girls and women. In terms of midwives, for example, because the Taliban has told girls from grades 7 to 12 that they can't go to school, they can't access the higher education that they need to fulfill this important job. So right now we have 15,000 midwives in Afghanistan where we already have terrible maternal mortality and infant mortality, and we're not going to be getting any more. You know, 1 million girls are out of school right now. And shockingly, because, as we mentioned earlier in the show, because there's a humanitarian crisis, Afghan families are finding themselves in the wrenching position of not being able to provide for everybody in their family, which is leading some of them to make contracts to enter their girls into marriage so that they can go and live with another family and be cared for. The going price of a girl right now in Afghanistan can be as low as $200. It's more like $1,000 on average, but it's heartbreaking to see this tumble from the limited freedom that women did have in the last 20 years. Just going back to that midwife graduation that I was at, these were women who were like, wow, I can finally do something for my community and for my country. And I finally have knowledge and I'm empowered and I can be an important person in my community. And that's just gone. That's impossible. And that's what's weighing on my mind this week.
Catherine?
Well, like Anita, I think all of us who have been in journalism over the past two decades have had Afghanistan touch on our lives in some way or another. Before I was a Voice of America reporter, I worked in Afghanistan training Afghan journalists and spent a great deal of time in Kabul in a relatively peaceful time, 2011, 2012, and was able to work directly one-on-one with Afghan journalists, and in particular, one female Afghan journalist, who, of course, I will not name here, but she was roughly my age. We were both in our late 20s, both passionate about journalism. But of course, we were born in very different countries. And so the circumstances of our lives were very different. And I'll never forget how excited she was to see me because she said, "You are the very first female journalist I've ever met." She wanted to know everything about my life, everything about my work in journalism. And she expressed so much hope to me at that point about where her life could go with this new freedom, with the possibility of what Afghanistan might become. And of course, when I was watching the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I couldn't help but wonder where she is, if she's still alive, if she's doing the work that she loved so much. And now that we're marking the 1 year anniversary of that withdrawal, I'm, of course, thinking about her again and hoping that wherever she is safe and well and able to do the work that she cared so much about.
Lots of food for thought and lots to ponder and to meditate on. And we will end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to panelist VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.